Amen. Say good morning to all of you out in CD land who are listening to this on CD and the class of 2009. It's here. We had a nice club last night. For 15 out of the 19 who are able to, 15 out of the 20 who are able to be a part of the club, they did a very good job doing their unique experience speeches. Before we go to the book of Joel, which is an exciting book, I have PowerPoint up here. The whole book is not going to be PowerPoint. I only have some PowerPoint just to illustrate what this book is about, but I'll try to describe it for those of you out in CD land. Before I do, I'm going to read this. Cold is a relative thing. Have you heard this? 65 above zero, Floridians turn on the heat. People in Ohio plant gardens. 60 above zero, Californians shiver uncontrollably. People in Ohio sunbathe. 50 above zero, Italian and English cars won't start. People in Ohio drive with their windows down. 40 above zero, Georgians don their coats, thermal underwear, gloves, and wool hats. People in Ohio throw on a flannel shirt. 35 above zero, New York landlords finally turn up the heat. People in Ohio have the last cookout before it gets cold. 20 above zero, people in Miami all die. Ohioans close the windows. Zero, Californians fly away to Mexico. People in Ohio get out their winter coats. 10 below zero, Hollywood disintegrates. But the Girl Scouts in Ohio are selling cookies from door to door. 20 below zero, Washington, D.C. runs out of hot air, and people in Ohio let the dogs sleep indoors. 30 below zero, Santa Claus abandons the North Pole. Ohioans get upset because they can't start their snowmobiles. 40 below zero, all atomic motion stops. People in Ohio start saying, "Cold enough for ya?" And 50 below zero, Hell Fleet freezes over, and the Ohio public schools will open 2 hours late. So, Ohioans are tough dudes. They can handle all that. Right. We know that's not necessarily true. All right, let's take a look at the book of Joel as an exciting book. And in one sense, you could wrap it up with one word saying destruction. Destruction. It's about the day of the Lord, and it's about the destruction that would come. And so the question's asked right at the beginning, have you ever heard, you people who are older, do you remember what a locust plague was like? Have you ever been in a locust plague? He asks. And he goes on to describe the devastation that a locust plague will cause. Let me read to you just a quick note here about locust plagues and their devastation. First of all, the power, here it is. If all the locusts in a swarm only 2 square miles were to breed successfully, all the locusts in a swarm only 2 square miles were to breed successfully in only 4 generations, there would be a severe infestation of the entire 196 million square miles of the Earth's surface. If they could all breed successfully just in 2 square miles, then let me read you another one just to give you an idea of what you're talking about here of the power that some say when the locusts come, this is God's army. They call it God's army. Here's a quote from 15,000 quotations. This is number 4571. It's called "The Biggest Locust Swarm." The greatest swarm of desert locusts ever recorded was one covering, how many miles do you think? 2,000 square miles. Observed crossing the Red Sea in 1889. Such a swarm, to be that big, must have contained 250 trillion locusts, weighing about 500,000 1,000 tons. Now that's how much locusts would weigh in that particular section. That's been an actual recording of one. When there has been devastation in Israel, and I'll read you that quote, each man and woman was and child above a certain age was supposed to go out and bring in, I think it was 60 pounds of eggs daily. Let me read it to you. Here it is. No, sorry, 11 pounds. The government issued a proclamation in April 1915, requiring every man from 16 to 60, sorry, every man, not every man, woman, or child, every man from 16 to 60 years of age to gather 11 pounds of locust eggs daily and deliver them to the officials. Well, how much would it take to gather 11 pounds of locust egg? Well, I'm going to show you on here some people gathering locust eggs, the way you keep them from the plague from continuing. But 11 pounds every day? You got to go out and dig in the ground because they make holes in the ground. They put their eggs in the ground, and then they hatch, and then they grow into the adult. So you'll see that. I'll come back and read some more out of this book in a moment. First of all, I'm just going to give you an overview. This is a locust plague. This is one seen in one area of the world. This may have been the one in Australia, but they have a couple of them in here from Australia and Afghanistan. Look at these flying things. Now, have any of you ever been in a locust plague or a grasshopper plague? Grasshoppers? When they're all around you, one time I stopped to get gasoline on the way out to California. I was driving across the country, and I think we were somewhere in New Mexico. And I stopped to get gasoline, and there were these critters all over the place. Now, they weren't quite as high. But frankly, when they fly overhead, it is like the noise of chariots. So you'll see him describe that, like the noise of chariots. They make that much of a racket when they're flying. And when they fly overhead, guess what? What you do after eating, you have to relieve yourself. And people standing under the locust plague get these little droppings, like mice droppings, coming down from the sky all over them. And when there's a swarm, they literally darken the sky so you cannot see the sun or the moon. They darken the sky. And when they go through, it's like the Bible says, you'll read it in Joel, it was like the Garden of Eden before them and after them, like scorched earth. Like the Garden of Eden. Everything's lush, and when they're done, it looks like somebody burnt this whole area. They take everything down, and in fact, you'll read in here, back in that plague, back in the Middle East, in the early 1900s, an Arabic lady was out doing her, helping out with her chores out in the field, and she put her baby against the tree. And when the locust plague came through, they literally ate the face off of the baby. They eat everything in their wake. Before them, it's green, and afterwards, it's like a skeleton. Look at this. Mass of, and again, as you see this mass of locusts in the air from this slide. Look at these people trying to battle these, go through them, walking through, and they're just flying all over the place. Horrible. There's another example. Trying to go through, and and this isn't even so bad. This isn't quite so thick. There you see them gathering locusts. Apparently, locusts are still eaten in Yemen. You know, the Bible talks about locusts are okay. Anybody ever eat a locust? They used to kind of have people take them and fry them and eat them. In fact, there was one time when New York, in the Chicago area, one of our ministers was having a camp out for the kids and the adults. I think it was more for the adults than kids because the adults were acting like kids anyway. The adults were there, and they all decided they were going to go out and pick up a grasshopper or something and roast it. Apparently you tear out the inside, and then you roast the outside or whatever. I said, no thanks. One of the guys thought I was being rebellious. I said, no, I choose not to eat it. And they were, everybody else was going to eat one. Well, fine, everybody else can eat it. I'm not. Now, if I get hungry enough, maybe I'd eat them. But you apparently, when you roast them, they taste like peanuts from what I hear. I haven't experienced that yet. And I, from the lack of hands, I think any of you have either. There again, you see them sweeping up the locusts in this picture, trying to clean up the streets. And here you see four types of locusts. See the gregarious stage down at the bottom, the solitary stage when they fly by themselves, when they're not in mass and swarms. The gregarious when they're all flying together, that's when they're very dangerous. And you see them throughout, different photos in color of them, close up. Area of the desert locust, and the desert locust is the one of the Bible, and it's the most damaging of all. You see, the recession areas in dark green, that's where they go after they've done their duty. But the invasion area, you see the whole yellow area, which includes the Middle East and Northern Africa and Central Africa and over in Spain, into Spain, that's where the main areas of the desert locust are. Life cycle of a locust. You see the egg being deposited or in the ground, then you see it becomes a nymph, and then it finally goes to an adult, and then the adult will then, female of course, will lay the eggs in the earth again. So they make holes in the ground. So to gather the eggs, you'd have to go through and dig into the ground and find those eggs and bring them out of the ground. Look at this locust plague in Australia. See all them flying overhead. You imagine a mass of them flying overhead, so thick and so dark that they blackened the sky. And they made the noise of chariots. The locust plague in Afghanistan. Lady trying to walk under it. As a desert locust plague, again, look at, see how the white clouds are almost blotted out in the mass, in the central part of it. And then we see locust feeding. Looks delicious on that green. And when they're done, it's just stripped white. Again, a mass of locusts all feeding. How would you like to see that in your backyard? Or in your field or among your crops? And there's a locust perhaps laying eggs. I didn't have identified what it was doing. And here, collecting locust eggs, people digging in the ground to find the locust eggs. Now you're going to see bags of them. Watch. Bags full. Those are just locust eggs. Full of locust eggs. The only way you're going to stop this plague is to stop the locusts from increasing. Or pray for storks. Storks, when they come, and they did in Israel to save them from really a bad plague, storks appeared overhead. They love locusts. And when one stork apparently fell down and died or whatever, they found in its gut over 1,400 locusts in its belly. So it just consumed those locusts. But look at this, bags full. But how many eggs would you have to get to gather to make 11 pounds? No, I don't know. It didn't say why it died. It just said when they found this stork, they found in its belly. I don't know if it had fallen, run into a tree because it was trying to do par four or whatever. Anyway. Are these locusts the locusts of Revelation, chapter 9, verse 7? Look, a similar helicopter's look to a locust. And let's go back to the helicopters. Are these the helicopters, or the locusts of Revelation 7? Are these the locusts of Revelation 7 flying overhead making noise? So that's it. I just wanted to give that because I think a picture is worth a thousand words, and there's no way I could have described locusts to you. The Bible does a pretty good job of it. Okay, let's go back and get some background to the book of Joel. And by the way, locusts are from the classification of Orthoptera, and the most dangerous plant pests are locusts and other kinds. And this comes from one of the articles I pulled off the internet. Disasters. They're one of the most dangerous plant pests are locusts and other types of grasshoppers, armyworm, and birds. The desert locust poses a recurrent threat to the agriculture throughout Africa, north of the equator, near the Near East, and Southwest Asia. Talks about locusts. Listen to this. Grasshoppers are herbivorous with a lively appetite, daily consuming a quantity of food equivalent to their own weight. Indeed, at times, their appetite becomes positively voracious and they can devour much vegetation cultivated and wild, especially pasture, to create a very real problem. So again, man has called these locusts by various different names. Go to your handout that I gave you on Joel, and you'll see that his name means Yahweh is God, Joel, Jehovah El, you know, like E-L is the word for God, and the J-O being for God. So it means Yahweh, Y-H-V-H, is God. The date is unknown. We're not sure. Some have dated it early, 800 to 700. That's what we will take, an early dating. I'll give you reasons why we would take an early dating as opposed to a late dating. Assyria is not mentioned. Egypt and Philistia are mentioned. There are no problems with the priesthood mentioned. There's no impending disaster. It was placed between Hosea and Amos in the canon. So why is it placed so early in the canon if it were a later written book? This is the thought. All these are just thoughts. The theme is the day of the Lord. Theme is the day of the Lord. It's used five times in this very short book. It isn't used the most. Okay, we'll see Zephaniah uses it seven times. Outline of this particular book is there's a locust plague described, chapter 1. Chapter 2, the day of the Lord and a call to repentance. And chapter 3, look back and then looking forward toward the kingdom of God. Looking back to why they had to receive this punishment, and looking forward. In effect, what Joel does, he primarily writes to the southern kingdom, and he uses the dreaded locust plague to bring across the point of what a future army will do. So he uses a locust plague, a dread locust plague, to bring across to the peoples how devastating, because they would know this if they remembered, how devastating God's army would be. It's written primarily to the southern king. We mentioned that. Locusts are God's army. They're called by several different names. In fact, I believe it is the Italians call them cavalletta, and it means little ponies. And the Germans call them Heupferde, which means a hay horse. And the Arabs call it God's army. God's army. In some ways, they resemble, just the way their heads are, they resemble little horses too, little ponies. So they are God's army, and God's command is being executed through his instruments. Now, he's not going to use a locust plague, but he will use an army. And two things we have to try to figure out. Again, what is he saying here? What do they represent? Well, they do represent a literal locust plague. So he goes through and he describes what a literal locust plague would do to the land. And he talks about, do you remember what happens when a locust plague comes through? How devastating it is. How it looks green before them and after them. It looks like it's been burned completely. They talk about skeletons. Let me read some of this to you. To the ancient Hebrews, the very name locust seems to have suggested all that our English term, they give a different term, conveys all that is woeful. Their scientific name is Acridium peregrinum, excuse me for my lack of Latin or whatever. When first hatched, they are quite black and resemble large ants, having no sign of wings, but they develop as they develop, they cast off their outer skins, which become outgrown, and molt through three stages, which are plainly distinguishable, namely the larva, which is the wingless stage, called by the Arabs Debi, the pupa, with wing sacs developing, and they called Gauga, and the full-fledged flying locust known as Jared. The males are by far the handsomer and have a vivid yellow body. The females are larger but a deep brown. The latter, the females, deposit their eggs 4 inches deep into the soil, no matter how hard the soil is. So they must have some drills on the end of their sacks or whatever. When the insects are fully developed, they're about 2.5 inches long, their heads resembling horses. Hence, the Germans called them Hoitpferde, hay horses, the Italians Cavalletta, little ponies, and the Arabs Dajesh Allah, God's army. In fact, they do resemble flying fighters. They do climb over walls and enter homes and make the air to quiver. They have been estimated to fly at a rate of 12 miles an hour. The reason I'm spending a lot of time with this, we can go through the book pretty rapidly once you get some background of what he's talking about. It makes much more sense when he talks about like the noise of chariots, like a soldier, like an army. He doesn't say they are an army. He says like. But what do they portray? What are they used for? To portray devastation. Now, there are two possibilities. We'll come back and discuss that. I'll just put it in your mind right now. Two possibilities. Are these locusts talking about the United States of Europe or this coming beast power? Or are they talking about the power that's to come after the beast power and do them in? Because one sense, it could be either way, because he talks about blow the horn in Zion. Is that a warning to Israel today, United States and Great Britain, to wake up because they're about to get their comeuppance? Or is it a warning, is this a warning to the peoples of Israel who threw in with the beast power and the name of the ones upon whom Israel's name was named, modern Israel, that is, as we understand, the Israelites of today in U.S. and British Commonwealth countries are already in captivity, and the ones who threw in with the beast power will now, along with the beast power, receive their comeuppance from the greatest army that ever was. So you have these two pictures in Revelation. You have the one that's says locusts, and you have the other one that's like a 2-million-man army. The largest army. So is it that large army coming against the beast power with its associated Israelitish countries, or is it the beast power coming against the modern day understanding of who Israel is today? Not the land of Israel, but Israelites as we understand them today. So anyway, he goes on to say, Jerusalem, the plague, 1915, most vivid description was given. Mr. Whiting describes the plague as beginning in February of 1915 of that year, the same year that my mom was born, 1914. So she was only 1 year old. Mr. Whiting describes that she wasn't over there at that time. Mr. Whiting describes the plague as being late in February of that year, as extending over all of Palestine and Syria from the borders of Egypt to the Tarsus Mountains. Similar plagues are known to have overtaken at least the portions of Palestine and give several years in which they were done. But this one's 1915. He describes it this way. A loud noise was heard before the locusts were even seen. So because of that many locusts flying in the air, you can actually hear a loud noise coming. What's that noise coming from? And it's locusts. Produced by the flapping of myriads of locust wings and resembling the distant rumbling of waves, Revelation 9:9. The sun was suddenly darkened. Showers of their excrement fell thick and fast, resembling those of mice. How would you like to be under that? And you start getting pelted, not by freezing rain. You start getting pelted by droppings from above. Their elevation above the earth was at times hundreds of feet. At other times, they flew quite low, detached numbers of them landing, In Jerusalem, at least, Mr. Whiting says, they invariably came from the northeast and go toward the southwest. So they came from the northeast. Who's in the northeast of Jerusalem? Northeast, as I would recall, isn't that where Assyria is? Yeah, northeast of Jerusalem. Northeast coming southwest, going down through Africa. Establishing the accuracy of Joel's account in chapter 2, verse 20. Tons were captured and buried alive. Many were thrown into cisterns or into the Mediterranean Sea, and when washed ashore, were collected and dried and used for fuel in Turkish baths. The government issued a proclamation in April 1915 requiring every man from 16 to 60 years of age to gather 11 pounds of locust eggs daily and deliver them to the officials. The stork, which the Arabs call Abu Sa'ad, the father of good luck, was especially numerous over Palestine in 1915 and greedily devoured the innumerable host of the locust pest. Hens gorged themselves on them. As I said, they found over 1,400 in one. That comes from the encyclopedia here that I have. By the way, I'll have to pass this around so you can see locust plagues and take a look at some more of the pictures close up. Mr. Aronson, another witness of the plague in 1915, testifies that less than 2 months after their first appearance, not only was every green leaf devoured, but the very bark was peeled from the trees, which stood out white and lifeless as skeletons. The fields, he says, were stripped to the ground. Even Arab babies left by their mothers in the shade of some trees had their faces devoured before their screams were ever even heard. They just got on them, and in a devouring stage, they'll just eat anything in its path. The natives accepted the plague as a just judgment upon them because of their wickedness, and usually they saw it as God's wrath upon them. It was accordingly a calamity such as this which Joel employed to call the husbandmen, the vineyard, vine dressers, the priests, and the drunkards of his day to repentance. In his picture of their ravages, he describes the beasts and the lower animals as also suffering with men, of course they would, and as standing pathetic in their mute appeal. Dire calamity and their sufferings being an omen of the dread day of Jehovah, which was about to come. So then it talks about how should we interpret this. He says the best interpretation is historical, but there certainly are some spiritual ones as well. I thought I would share that part with you. Again, the two possibilities is if Joseph is being punished, chapter 2 says, blow the horn in Zion. Sound the alarm, because something, this great devastation is coming. Chapter 1, he describes devastation. Chapter 2, he tells Israel, blow the horn in Zion, because devastation is coming. Now, if by Zion he means the children of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, then that would have to take place before, actually, the day of the Lord. But in the day of the Lord, you have two armies present. You have the beast power, and you have the second army that's supposed to be 200 million. And also the plague in this particular section is called the greatest army. There's never been the like. And in Revelation, it also calls that army, there has never been the like. The one that's going to come against the beast power as we understand it. So two possibilities. Is it the first woe, or is it the second woe? Is it the first woe, or is it the second woe? I'm not prepared to say which one it is. I don't know that I could identify for sure. We'll take a look at it as we go through the book. I said I would give you some reasons why I believe it is early dated, and this comes from different research, from different commentaries. First of all, from around 800, its position in the 12, it's with the earlier books, Hosea and Amos. Assyria is not mentioned at all as a power, not mentioned at all. There are no idols and no denunciations of them, which they later got into turning away from God through idolatry and Sabbath breaking. Number four, the term elders is mentioned, and elders have always been a name that's been used. Philistines are mentioned along with Edom and Egypt, which tended to be powers earlier than later. And 27 of his clauses are used out of 73 have parallels in other Old Testament books. So the thought is this was written earlier, and those same thoughts and those same concepts that were brought by one prophet were then taken and elaborated upon by others. Also, Joel's originality in bringing this out indicates he didn't copy from someone else or didn't have a forerunner to pave the way. And early Hebrew literature has rhythm just like Joel's writing is, has a rhythm in the way it's written. Early Hebrew literature rather than later Hebrew literature. Now, the reason some date it later, like 400 B.C., is because he calls the people scattered. So it's almost like they have already been scattered. He also calls them a remnant. He also talks about bringing back the captivity, which seems to indicate they were in captivity already. And no king is mentioned. So their king had already been taken away, according to them. Hoshea, last king, was killed or taken away. And Jerusalem had been plundered. So those are some of the, and there's one more, commentators, some feel it is a late date. So those are some reasons. So I would go with early date rather than late date, just to let you know there are questions about when it was written. So when it was written, I don't know. You know, I can give you dates all over the place depending on which commentary I read. And are they certain? No, they're not certain. Remember the sequence of end time events. You have tribulation, you have heavenly signs, you have the day of the Lord, you have the millennium. Of course, remember, day of the Lord can mean what else when God deals with that people, when God deals with you. So who is this written to? It's written to the southern kingdom, and it's also written to Zion, possibly the Israel, the Zion portion, the Israel part that collaborated with the beast power, or for all of Israel. Little is known of Joel's background. Little is known of his personal background. We already said his name means the Lord, Yahweh is Lord. There are many men in the Bible with the same name. There are 12 men who use the same name, Joel. So don't think Joel, every time you read Joel, it's the Joel of minor prophets. He was a native of Jerusalem. If early dating is correct, Joel would have been the first prophet to use the term day of the Lord. If early dating, like 800, he would have been the first prophet to use the day of the Lord. Okay, I think that's all I want to share with you there on background. We talked about the locusts. Let's see if there's anything else I want to share with you. Who are these locusts? Wilmington brings out some facts. It's considered to be an actual event in the Middle East. They are known to swarm and darken the sky, a literal happening, causing tremendous devastation. Apparently they happened often enough for some to perhaps remember. Let's take a look at Revelation real quickly before we actually get into the book. Revelation chapter 9. Why I said it could either be the first woe or the second woe being described, the people of the first woe. Here's the first woe, which is the fifth trumpet. So this is after God's ready to intervene, right? The seventh trumpet is Christ's return. But the trumpet plagues already indicate God's day of the Lord. And I believe by the time the day of the Lord comes, those who are Israelite-ish, that is, Joseph's children, will already be in captivity somewhere. In fact, they will be, those who are pure Israelites will be sealed, Revelation 7. Says they will be sealed. So in Revelation 9, he says in verse 1, and the fifth angel sounded, I saw a star fall from heaven to the earth, and to him was given the key, probably an angel, of the bottomless pit. or the abyss. And he opened this abyss. He opened up the bottomless pit. I guess it had a trapdoor on it or whatever. And there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. Now, the sun and the moon are darkened, but it's not because of flying locusts. It's because of the smoke. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. So here, locust is used as a description of this beast power. I believe this is the beast power he's talking about here, and he even talks about it. And to him was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. What did scorpions do? They sting. I was watching a part of a James Bond movie was on the other night, and the guy, in order to kill this man, they take, I don't know why they shoot the guy. You know, if they want to kill somebody, shoot the guy. So they took a scorpion, had it in this bag, and this guy's trying to tell them something. They pulled his shirt up and dumped the scorpion down his back, and about 2 seconds, he falls over dead. Scorpions have power to hurt. That's the key. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. So you see, God had already sealed. Whom had he sealed? Revelation 7, 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was a torment of a scorpion when he strikes a man. Like, what could this be? Who knows? Who knows what it is? Some theorized nerve gas or whatever could hurt them but not kill them. And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. Is it poison gas? Is it some type of nerve gas? What is it? We don't know. And the shapes of the locusts were like horses. Voila, that's what they call them, little horses. The shapes of the locusts were like horses prepared to battle. And on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold. And their faces were as the faces of men. And they had hair as the hair of women. And their teeth were as the teeth of lions. Now remember, here is John living in the first century, trying to describe something in the future. Now, think about what you would say if you saw television for the first time. You never had seen it. Wouldn't you wonder what those people are doing in a box? How'd those people get in that box? And you didn't know anything about electronics. How'd you get those people in the box? Or if you take this thing and somebody talks to you, a voice you recognize on a telephone. What is this? Hey, that sounds like my mother. Yeah, it's your mother. She's calling. What? My mother? Can't believe it. You know, think of the things that we have. The planes fly overhead. Huge, multi-ton planes. Scraps of steel and other fabric flying overhead. What would you think? I still am awestruck. We lived in Toronto, Canada. We lived right on the flight path, landing, descent path of planes. And we would step out in our backyard, and we would have we could sit there and count, 10, 20, 30, 40 planes coming over. Not all at the same time, of course, but one after the other. But they were big planes. You could see them. Their landing gear was already down because the airport was only about 6 or 7 miles from us. It was right on their landing path. We could see them coming overhead. I still am fascinated with what keeps that piece of metal in the sky. I know, I understand physics, but I still am fascinated by it. But think about people who had never seen something like that. Now here's John trying to describe the best he can. Perhaps he sees helicopters. Perhaps he sees these planes. Did you ever see warplanes and what they sometimes did to them when they painted teeth on the front so that it looked like these were like tigers or whatever coming after them? And he sees this. And if you were in a helicopter, you could actually see people in a helicopter. It looks like two big eyes there. And if you look more closely, you see people in there too. So he's trying to describe. He says the teeth were as the teeth of lions. In this case, he's saying they were strong, powerful. They had breastplates as they were breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots, many horses, sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. Now, if they thought that's what it sounded like for a locust plague, what must it sound like for jet engines? The roar of those planes. I still am fascinated with planes. I love to see them. I love to watch them. And when you see a plane, and we had a chance to go to the, up here, they had a, Dayton has a air show, but I think it's after you graduate. But it's well worth going to. You can walk around and see all of them, and then they have these planes come over, and these stealth bombers and these stealth fighters that come, and it almost looks like they kind of change direction in midair, which they do. And it's amazing just when you see them. And then when you see the awesome aircraft that they have, which you will see because March 18th is our field day to the Air Force Museum. You're going to have a chance to see the helicopters and the locusts up there if these are what are being portrayed in this area. So he says, and they had tails like scorpions. You ever see out of the tails come the vapor trail? And also, in some cases, they have tail gunners in the olden days, and who knows what picture they were given here. They were, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. So you have this warfare, perhaps conventional warfare. Perhaps by that time, mankind had said, no, if we start this nuclear battle, we will all be wiped off the face of the earth. And maybe they had a good enough sense that they didn't want to be wiped off themselves, so they didn't initiate it. They had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name is, in the Hebrew, his tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue, his name is Apollyon. And one woe is past. Behold, there's another. There comes two more woes. So the first woe, or the fifth trumpet plague, is telling you about this great beast power. This great power. Awesome power. Military might. And then notice verse 13. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the great golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates, and the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. So let them go. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, 200 million. And I heard the number of them, and thus I saw the horses in vision, and them that sat on them having breastplates. And he goes on to talk about this greatest army. Talks about the power was in their tails. So both of them seem to be described like devastation. One is called the greatest army that ever was. 200 million men is pretty awesome. 200,000, 200 million. So is that the one of Joel? Or is it the other? I don't lean either way. I don't know which one it is. That's why I put that forth to you. But Joel is warning, nonetheless, of disaster that's going to come. I'm going to give you four comparisons before I stop. We won't even get into the chapter one today. But I'm going to give you four comparisons that are used, five comparisons that are used for the locusts. Number one, a nation. A nation. He calls them a nation because of the hordes and the numbers of them being so numerous and as coming as a group. Proverbs 30, verses 25 to 27, talks about locusts being like a nation. Secondly, they're likened to a lion because of their jaws and their devastating power. Revelation 9, verses 7 and 8. Thirdly, they're likened to a horse because the head looks very similar to the head of a horse and because of their speed. Job 39 and verse 20. Job 39, verse 20. The fourth comparison is a chariot because they are tireless of men of war as men of war. And they make a great deal of noise. Joel 2 and verse 5. Just the sound of the chariots rumbling through. You know, when people hear the tanks, or when Israel invaded in the Middle East, invaded the Gaza area, and they showed all those tanks ready to go, and you see these tanks rumbling through the area, that shakes you up, just the noise of it. And then number five, God's army. God's army. By tradition, because of such a powerful retribution and the devastation brought about. Joel 2, verse 11. Chariots, Joel 2, verse 5. God's army, Joel 2, verse 11. So those are five comparisons that we'll see, and we'll see him saying, like the noise of chariots, and like the soldiers, and like, I'll show you where to mark that in chapter 2. Okay, that gives us some background to the book of Joel. Yes? Proverbs 30, verses 25 to 27. All right? Second comparison was of a lion. A lion, Revelation 9, verses 7 and 8. Okay, have a good rest of the day. We'll see you this afternoon.